Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
The Platypus by Anne Morrell, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world. And this is episode 2, and we've dealt with the initial discovery by white man of the platypus, and how it was driven by curiosity. It was sort of like the icon of early enlightenment, or the mid enlightenment, where this creature was made of what looked like a duck, a beaver, and a bird, all put into one, baffled them, and got people really excited in Germany and England. And there's sort of the other axis of power, which is the French, and this is the episode 2. But it is of importance that when they asked the native people, they said, oh, it has complex burrows and it lays eggs. So this is knowledge, you know, way, way ahead of anybody else. Now, this is called The Frenchman's Gaze. Now, this is a real insight by the platypus. So the platypus is an allegory, I think, for independent academics anyway, where they just don't fit in. They've got this eclectic knowledge. It just doesn't go together. It's not processed. So I rather like that. And that Anne Morrell has actually developed the Independent Scholars Association of Australia, the IAA. And it seems to be a rather quiet organization, namely to allow, I think, women historians, as far as I can read, to write things. This aspect is from the French, and it really gives an insight into French power as seen through the lens of a platypus. Now, quote, "Nature leads us to a dance in a far continent." And this is a François Perron, "A Voyage of Discovery in the Southern Hemisphere," performed during the years 1801, 1802, 1803, and 1804. That's a book. Now, while Britain's Endeavour, which is Captain Cook's super exploration ship voyage, opened up a rich and unexpected treasures of the scientific world, other nations and scientists hankered to play their part in unfolding geographic and natural history discoveries and to secure a foothold in the reputation for themselves. The challenge compelled Europe's recognised scientific leader, France. Hence, now it's interesting that France was such a powerhouse. That's just boggles the mind, yet they didn't really integrate it into their military, as far as I could see. Hence, even while the revolution tore at the roots of French society, successive governments, monarchists, revolution, and Napoleonic, launched a series of elaborately equipped expeditions to visit the south lands and collect specimens for the famous Museum of Natural History in Paris, which was set up in the revolution and was the brainchild, of Lamarck, as Lamarck historians say. The museum, and so Lamarck got pushed out from his position, so he's on the periphery position, and he, in an evening, wrote up a plan for the Natural History Museum, and it was adopted by the revolutionaries, who were just bereft of policies. So, yeah, we'll do it. It was hence to be a considerable surprise of this small British enclave of army officers, convicts, making the first rural acquaintance with the country in Port Jackson. That's Botany Bay. Not Botany Bay, that's Sydney Cove. There's a little few camps there. But two French vessels, L'Astrobe and La Boussole, under the command of Comte de Perouse, sailed into Sydney Harbour in February 1788. So we were there in January, and, you know, that is, I think, a mere 3 weeks after the British had landed. Now, it's interesting that they didn't... did this spur the declaration or the proclamation of Australia? So, unknown to historians going into it, think that crudely in January 26, right, that Australia was proclaimed, but it wasn't officially proclaimed until several weeks into the actual arrival there. And it's hard to understand what this proclamation is. So it's almost back from ancient times that it's sort of like gazetting a law. And what you do is stand on a hill or a prominent thing with people around you, and you read very forcefully aloud a statement, and that proclaims the statement, and that becomes sort of semi-law. So it's not who writes it, why is it written, is it fair, is it logical? No, it's just a statement read out, and everyone says, we'll strike, we'll go from, well, when I say strike, it's not, we will start things from there, things from this position change their nature. Okay, sponsored by Louis the 17th. Oh yeah. The two ships carried an array of scientists, two astronomers, a naturalist, a botanist, a mineralogist, a meteorologist, a geographer, a gardener, botanical, and a landscape draftsman, and two chaplains who were also experienced naturalists. Now I should say these poor people get shipwrecked a bit later, but we'll see what they say. The exploring party spent over 2 weeks on the northern shores of Botany Bay, in what is now bears the captain's name. It could be a Botany Bay. Which now bears the captain's name. Oh, Botany Bay, yes, not Port Jackson. So I went to Botany Bay and looked on the northern shores before they sailed out between the great sandstone heads of Port Jackson in early March and vanished into the blue horizon. In 1791, as tumbrils rolled across the streets of Paris, the French National Academy dispatched the Admiral de Entrecasseaux to search for La Pérouse and ships, named appropriately La Recherche, or Admiral de Entrecasseaux, the Research and the Esperance. We have Esperance in Australia, and Research Bay. But what I have to say about this, yeah, so 1791, the French Revolution's in full swing, and the French Academy, the Musée, Natural Museum, is about to get started. While the search brought no return, and the wreck of La Pérouse's ships would not be discovered off the New Hebrides for another 40 years. So there's an arc of islands coming across from Papua New Guinea. So we're in New Holland, and these are New Caledonia and New Hebrides. They're these sort of islands. Bourneville. Is it Bourneville? All these islands across, all these, what is it, Guam Canal, all these things that the Japanese got into. While the search, the expedition conducted a cartographic surveys around Australia's coast through the outstanding botanist Jacques Julien de la Billardry. It made impressive collections of Australian flora and yielded two botanical volumes of the voyage and linked Australia to the scientific enterprise of France. Which is interesting, because that's Napoleon Bonaparte. So you can imagine these people want to outdo each administration, which sent off a thing, wanted to do better. You know, we can do a moon landing, so to speak. Napoleon Bonaparte's advent to power gave further impetus to French science. On his famous Egyptian campaign in 1798, he carried along with his invading corps no less than 150 savants and a large travelling library in order to investigate everything about the country he planned to command. Its ancient monuments, its flora, its fauna, the great annually flooding Nile, the medicinal values of mummies, and the mysterious birth process of baby crocodiles. Now, this is interesting in terms of power and science. To legitimise your power, you need science. It's the most incredible thing. And whereas Australia was not built necessarily Cook's expedition was the discovery of Australia was in a scientific thing to observe the eclipse and to check out their computation power. So Cook navigated with GPS precision using computational sheets by computers and anti-computers of people who struggled a year to calculate in advance the orbit of Jupiter. Now, you might think that's hard, but, or it's easy, but it's not hard. It's not easy because you've got all these effects happening, and even atmospheric effects people began to calculate in as they set up some tables and work out that they're wrong. Or, sorry, they're try their calculations and realize they're out by a certain amount. So a bit of a dead reckoning in there. Okay, science and its national potential ran hotly through the emperor's veins. But while Napoleon himself was obliged to return to France in 1799 and his Egyptian army succumbed to great loss of life before it united efforts of British and Turks, many of its court of savants stayed on to continue their scholarly work to compete the monumental description d'Egypt, eventually published in Paris in 24 volumes between 1808 and 1824. Now, it's also very interesting that science was not considered to be involved in political affairs. So your army could go, but your scientists would remain behind, or scientists could travel between warring. But there was actually something called a scientific passport. So, during the American Revolution, Benjamin Franklin issued, tried to explain to the Americans this scientific concept, saying, if you see Cook, you've got to give him assistance. Even though he's the enemy, because he's a scientist, you have to give him supplies. I think by that time Cook had actually carked it, but the letters were out. Coming along. So it's very interesting to do with that. And Napoleon himself was, he was basically a politician, sort of going with the wind, missing the important things. So he, although the French had command of balloons and skies, and he could see, no one told him the potential to use one to look over the battlefield and get incredible views. And no one said that to him. The French had semaphores. However, he did have an entire balloon army that he wanted to sail to Britain in balloons, and actually sold Louisiana to the Americans to fund his balloon army. People don't know that. This is true. And of course, the balloon army was a complete flop. He was going to do an air invasion of Britain. So it shows that he had science, but he had not a realistic view of science. In 1800, the little Corsican adventurer turned his bright eyes southward, taking up an agreement with the Institut of France to extend man's knowledge of the habitable regions of the earth. Napoleon commissioned the most expensive and splendidly equipped maritime expedition yet to set out from any country, putting under the command of an experienced geographer, Captain Nicholas Bourdon. In its scientific and political mission, it was explicit to cross the world to New Holland to conduct, Australia's New Holland, to conduct botanical, zoological, anthropological, meteorological research for the greater glory of France, and in the midst of a war with Britain to secure France's own cartographer's accurate and strategic hydrographic surveys of the Australian coast. So this is why we have the British giving Flinders a used ship. One of the things to understand is that ships have a sweet spot when they're built. So if you build a ship right away and sail it, it can fall apart, it can be a lemon. But generally a ship has to be at sea at this time for about 3 years. Then it's a sweet spot. It's got a couple of years sailing. And after that it just goes downhill, downhill, downhill. And that's happened with the British ship. So France and Britain are going around. Few nations showed such flair for naming their exploring vessels as the French. When the smartly titled La Geography and La Naturalist, accompanied by the schooner Crescenda, sailed from Le Favre in October 1800, they carried on board 23 civilian scientists, including 5 zoologists, a medley of anthropologists, botanists, mineralogists, physical scientists, natural history artists, their task barely more moderate than the Egyptian venture was to study the Antropocene physical and natural world and its unknown indigenous inhabitants. Okay, so one of the things is that they did name their ships a scientific ship. Okay, this is a scientific ship. It looks a bit different from a normal ship. So the Endeavour was not a fighting ship. It was a specially designed research ship. It was basically a cargo ship. But, you know, it was the top of the state of the art at that stage. And these were, and I don't think these were armed. I think the British still armed. The Endeavour may have been armed. It wasn't armed. But the Investigator was. Plying its way around Cape Hope and Mauritius, French ships reached Cape Leeuwin. Now, Mauritius is a French island in the, very French, in the Indian Ocean. On the south coast of West, Cape Leeuwin, on the south coast of Western Australia in 1801. They travelled northwards to Timor and surveyed parts of the indented northern Australian coast before turning south to sail along a sweep of eastern Australia to Tasmania. Later, La Geographie moved along the southern coast of the huge continent and met Matthew Flinders' investigator. That's a dodgy ship with a couple of guns set up, Adam Canterbate. Now, we know there's guns because he, at a point, the ship was sinking. He hurled the guns off, and now Australian divers have found those guns off the deserted coast of South Australia. While war raged between the countries on land and sea in Europe, Flinders and his botanist, Robert Brown, he's the Brown in motion, okay? You know, the Brown in motion, he's not a, as they say in Australian textbooks, a country parson. He's a out there a botanist travelling the world and circumnavigating Australia and naming a lot of Australian plants from Brown in motion. Climbed aboard La Geographie to meet the captains and members of his scientific crew and drink a toast to the internationalism of science. So at this stage, when science was first born, it was not a tool of nations. It was its own itself, a new religion. La Geographie enjoyed a friendly hospitality of the government and residents for several months. Also, they met again in Port Jackson in 1802, which is about 2 years later. And stuff. Now, the interesting thing is that the investigator was just a complete wreck of a ship, and they rebuilt it. The French naturalists would meet the platypus in New South Wales. The expedition's zoological recorders, the naturalist François Perron, natural history artist Charles Lesser, had already made large collections of specimens and fauna life in Tasmania, its offshore island and Kangaroo Island of South Australia. When they turned their gaze to the fauna around the perennial settlement of Sydney, trained in medicine and nominated to the expedition as a zoologist in training, the celebrated French systematist, Perron was alive to Europe's scientific interest in the platypus and to the furry Australians and the flurry of Australia's improbable fauna and had stirred. His descriptive notes and Lasseur's drawings of the two living specimens in their natural environments in New South Wales, a brown female and a russet male, were precise. They presented two fully defined platypuses, a sketch of a skull with its jaws open and details of the masticatory plates, which is the bills, and indicative of their grasp of the animal's unusual anatomical organisation, a sketch of its underside with the tail of a female platypus showing a common opening for the genital organs, excrement and urine. So it's a monotreme. Gathering their specimens for transport to Paris, the two, it's rather sad that the British ships were crap. And so they got beautiful specimens back. And you see, I'd love to visit the Natural Museum now. Some of these British museums are really great. The Continental Museums are fantastic. Frenchmen carefully added the skeleton of a male platypus to their fauna collection. While Perrault described and recorded, and the talented Lesser shot and painted his specimens, this is to believe that the people have guns. If they want to get a thing, they just shoot it and go up to it. And it's hard to remember that Banks used to go around with his country, English country gun and shoot everything and get his greyhounds to run after it. It was just real, it's sort of like the fox hunt. Perrins described and recorded the talented shot and painted specimens capturing the last villages on paper in the swift course of a day. The expedition itself piled up with disasters. Dysentery and scurvy pinned it in Sydney Harbour for several months. See, they still hadn't fixed the scurvy thing. The intense ill feeling of the expedition assailed the captain. Bad management, poor teamwork, and inadequate knowledge of supplies of healthy rations multiplied the expedition's trials. In November, so they just didn't do what Cook did. In November 1802, the naturalists under the command of Louis Freinet embarked for France carrying members of the scientific corps who had fallen ill and a great part of the scientific collections, including an assortment of live animals. Nicolas Bourdin, extending his time on La Geographie at Port Jackson for several months, would die from tuberculosis on the Ile de France in 1803, along with a large number of his officers on the journey home. Death stalked the voyage, and only five of the expedition's entire complement of scientists and artists lived to return to France. That's just because they hadn't nicked the scurvy problem. The scientific outcome of the expedition, however, was immense. Monsieur Perrin Le Seur, France's scientific leader, Georges Cuvier, declared jubilantly, "We'll have made known new creatures than more new creatures than all the travelling naturalists of recent times put together." There are over 100,000 preserved animals, large and small, as well as 2,500 new species to scientists. It was a geological haul, significantly surpassing that of the two Pacific voyages of Cook. That's all they're interested in. The celebrated Geoffrey Saint-Hilaire was on the quay at Saint-Laurent in 1803 to greet La Naturalis when she dropped anchor with her preserved specimens and her live Atropodean ark. Three surprised wombats, an emu, a black swan, half a dozen parrots, two dingoes, a long-necked tortoise landed on French soils. And this is the along the tradition of going on scientific expeditions and collecting menageries, which has led to modern zoos. Bourdin had gone to great lengths to transport live animals and specimens and scientists home. His efforts incurred the open displeasure of officers who had to turn from their quarters in rough and cold weather to make room for the beasts. When months later the sadly depleted La Geographie limped into Laurent on March 1804, this cargo included one more live emu, a lyrebird, and several different kinds of kangaroo. French science had triumphed in the Southern Sea, yet muddle and ineptitude persisted. Perrin retreated to the country, riled by the lack of any settlement of his salary. And while the collection of shells, fish, reptiles, and zoophytes preserved in alcohol, quadrupeds, birds stuffed, dissected, as Perrin described them, were unpacked at the Museum of Natural History. It wasn't until 1904 that he was persuaded to return to Paris by an eminent committee of the Académie de Sciences to write up his own brilliant discoveries. Perrin, quick and independent, held qualities of genius. He was, moreover, the first transzoologist to land in Australia. Unlike the clever men of great repute, the rising comparative astronomers and scientific theorists in Paris would grapple with a few specimens of creation from Australia. Perrin had actually set foot on the unexamined world of the new fifth continent. It linked keen understanding with direct observation in the field. He sailed across the world with his zoological antenna alert. Yet once there, observing and describing, he found in the furry aquatic platypus and pouch kangaroo and the reversibly coloured black swan and the fleet but flightless emu, inversions and contraries of the natural, and that challenged a rational explanation. In the brilliant light of those southern hemispheres' days, he was consumed with curiosity and passion. But back in the old world, he no longer trusted the evidence of his eyes. In science, he wrote, New Holland defies our conclusions from the comparisons mock South studies and shakes the foundations and most firmly established and most universally admitted of our scientific opinions. The convict society, with its upside-down hierarchies and the popular population of miscreants who flourished in the New World, also surprised him. While the meteorological storms that blew savagely across the settlements bore no resemblance to the weather he knew in his own land, nature's society itself, he came to believe, leads us to dance in a far-off continent. I should say, if you go through the records, there are some humdinger storms which have never... There's been one or two absolutely terrifying storms come across here in Australia. This is huge hailstones. But around that time, there seems to have been a fair number of humdinger storms. So these are these massive storms. So I've only experienced one absolutely massive storm here. And this is a tornado, it's everything happening. Sea spouts, the whole lot. The rigors of the expedition was cut short as life. The talented Perrant died in 1810. The old man, in the words of one contemporary, at the age of 35. After the volume of the voyage was published in 1807, it fell to Charles Le Sœur, the expedition's other surviving natural history artist, M. Petit, to see the atlas volumes of the Discovery Voyage with its 41 beautiful illustrations, including the Orno Hor Hai Inchus into print. I'll get to how that's pronounced. That's going to be a tough one for Emma to pronounce. Yet, despite the expressed pleasure of blue ribbons committees in the Academy of Science, made up of some of the giants of French science, at the expedition's outstanding results in science, the collections did not become available for research. They are placed in the Paris Museum of Natural History, together with Perrin's meticulous recordings of external structures, characteristics, and the place and date of acquisition of his zoological specimens, but were not displayed. Perrin's great plan for a separate volume on the geography of his voyage also failed to win support for the authorities. Also, too, withheld the results of his labours, declining to place them in the Paris Museum, the drawings he had made to accompany Perrin's scientific descriptions. Instead, he took them to Philadelphia, where he moved in 1815. It was not until 1838, when interest in the exhibition had long since paled, that both Le Sœur's drawing and Perrin's material reached the Museum of Natural History at Le Havre, the city which the expedition embarked. Working over the materials in the late 90s, the curator of the exhibition, Terry Napoleon, Australia Through French Eyes, Susan Hunt. Look at that! That's why that was such a great expedition expo. I didn't get to see it. Suggested that these vast trophies of science were meant to be concealed. They were privileged knowledge and, as she wrote, regarded as much as nations' jealousies guard the seaboard exploration images of satellite maps. Okay, they were spy maps. Yet, they alone, rather than the strategic political outcomes of all that remained of Napoleon's ambitions to conquer the new scientific empire of the South. Perversely, it's not the visionary Napoleon, but his Empress Josephine who gave celebratory expression to the great venture her husband had so enthusiastically set in train. It was Josephine's private chateau, Malmaison, outside Paris. Now, this is a great thing, because we were, in the 90s, we got to France, we were absolutely poor, we couldn't afford bus fares or anything like that. And so Fiona, my blind wife, we would backpack, we would look and say, oh, we can walk to Malmaison. So we actually physically walked to Malmaison. And so Malmaison is this French chateau, but it's set in really suburban France. So you walk past car parks and car yards and houses, and all of a sudden you come up to Malmaison. Now, if you get there on a tourist bus, you think, oh, I'm in the middle of France, but you're actually in the middle of, say, some central suburb. It's pretty amazing. There, with François Perrault's aid, she established a menagerie of Australian animals. Oh, kangaroos, emus, parrots, swans, wombats and tortoises to roam the grounds. That was also included the seed cuttings of Australia's acacia, casuarina and grevillea trees. And the motif of the black tarn adorned the Empress's bed. Wow! So we were in Malmaison, but that Australian aspect didn't go. Yet the wheel of history swings full circle. In the last two decades of the 20th century, a detailed story of the Forgotten Voyage has been disinterred. The Art of Bodoen's expeditions published, and the drawings, maps and journals, objects of rich and distant undertaking brought to public view. Well, that's the most incredible male maison, because I've been there. And of course, in every chateau in every France where Napoleon's ever been, there's the map room. Everyone wants to see it. But that's incredible. And this is the entire idea of a menagerie. This is the idea you bring animals back and they form a menagerie. This is what the royals have. And they had, that's how the Natural Museum got going. They had, they took the palace and they had this menagerie. And so they didn't know what to do. And then they also had all these wild animals in the streets. They actually had a polar bear on display in the streets of Paris. And it wound up in the, you know, in the zoological gardens. The idea of menageries, and of course menageries went on to form two things. They went on to form circuses and they went on to form zoos, the menageries that travelled in the United States. Yet the wheel of, okay, one of those turns of the wheels was that rewarded the historian and bring the researcher keen to light. I found myself in 1999 standing at the exhibition of Terra Napoleum, which had travelled to Australia for display in Sydney and later the National Library in Canberra. And there, protected yet visit under shiny plastic frame, was the skeleton of a male platypus caught by Perron in 1802 in New South Wales and returned nearly two centuries later to declare it's part of the story of the great scientific enterprise. The skeleton, informed the inscription, is one of the only specimens which is possibly providence to Bonhomme Voyage existing in the Museum History Naturelle de Paris. Breaking on French eyes, Le Sieur's striking drawings, published in 1811, the atlas volume of his voyage, the platypus was indeed a very strange creature who spoke to the public, exhilarated by distance, exploration and discovery. But to comparative anatomists, puzzling on its place in the scientific register, although confirmed and formed, it was as scientifically enigmatic as before, a taxonomic riddle from across the globe. That ends chapter 2, only 32 minutes, but I think I'll do an episode, a chapter. Beautifully written book, and it's just got so much to it. And I like the high-level science in it, that the theory was that these were national secrets, secrets kept. So it's a fascinating thing to see. It's not a great thing that they were held there, and also the feeling that Josephine had loved having kangaroos and Australian fauna hopping around her Paris house, Malmaison. You should go and see it. If you go there, it's well worth seeing. Bye for now. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.